We heard all about the big announcement today from Governor Charlie Baker. Patriots Day is the day, April 19th. That is when the general public can start getting vaccinations in the Commonwealth. It turns out phase four of reopening next Monday is also now the same day that essential workers and people age 60 and older can be vaccinated. Those are true signs, maybe, of a new normal. But still, new variants are continuing to pop up here in Massachusetts and overseas. There are some questions over the health impact of the European AstraZeneca vaccine, which is not available here in the United States, but is reverberating here. So with all this news, we thought you might have as many questions as we always do. So it's time. It is Ask the Doctors. Call with your coronavirus and vaccine questions at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now to help answer as many of those questions as we can is Dr. Christopher Gill, an infectious disease clinician and researcher who focuses on vaccines and the epidemiology of respiratory diseases at Boston University, also an associate professor at the BU School of Public Health. We also have Dr. Sabrina Asumu, an assistant professor of medicine at Brown University School of Medicine and an infectious disease specialist at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Gill, welcome back.
So great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Asumu, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Great to have you both. I'm just going to start with your reactions from both of you about the announcement from Governor Baker today with this timeline. Dr. Asumu.
Yeah, no, it's great news. It's always wonderful to see progress. You know, I see patients at Boston Medical Center, and I can tell you that despite a lot of the headlines, I have a lot of patients who are eager to get vaccinated. So having a timeline of when we'll be able to vaccinate more people, different people with different conditions, but also having a date that the general public could sort of use as to when they can be eligible for the vaccine. I think this is all great news.
Dr. Gill, I have to admit, it did make a difference even to me just to know when that might be. So kind of how big of a deal is it to have this clarity now today?
Oh, it's such wonderful news, don't you think? I mean, I think we have all felt for, you know, ever so long now, like how long do we have to wait before we can sort of feel that life is returning to normal? And I think having a specific date in mind where at least we know that, you know, now we can officially get into the queue is psychologically so helpful. This is sort of a strange metaphor to use, but, you know, there's this old story about the frog in the frying pan, and you heat the water up slowly and the frog doesn't know to jump out because the change is just so gradual. And I think what we're kind of looking at is this frog in the frying metaphor, but running backwards, where we've been in the hot water for all this time. Mm. And we're trying to sort of figure out, like, when will it just feel like a regular day again? And I think the metaphor is helpful because it's not like there's going to be a single point in time when suddenly we say we are here, right? I think it's going to be a much more gradual thing where every day is a little bit better. And actually that the pace of change improves every day. So every day not only gets better, but it's getting better faster. You know, the vaccine supplies are expanding, the logistic problems are being worked out, the politics behind this are being solved. All these, you know, stepwise problems that are so essential in terms of like reaching that total goal of normalcy are being solved day after day after day. And the accumulated effect of those is that the pace of returning to normal, while it may not, we may never like wake up one day and say, here it is. We may wake up one day and say, my gosh, how did we get here? This feels normal again. Yeah. And I think that day is actually not so far off anymore.
I'm about to turn to the phones, but I do want to note for listeners, you can go to mass.gov and pre-register for the Commonwealth's mass vaccination sites there now, even if you're not eligible yet, and get in queue for when it's your turn to get a notification of a potential appointment. So that's mass.gov. Dr. Asumu, I'm going to turn to the phones. We'll get a question for you. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Chris on the line in Rockland. Chris, what's your question?
Yes, hi. I'm 66 with underlying health conditions. I'm getting my second vaccine on Saturday. I know you have to wait a couple of weeks to be fully immunized after the second shot. I'd like to know, how is it safe, given my underlying health conditions, for me to go out to dinner in a restaurant, to go get my hair colored, which takes about 2 hours at a real hair salon? Can I go shopping? And then very quickly, second question is, I'm scheduled for a second shingles shot. How soon after the second Pfizer shot can I get the shingle shot?
Well, Chris, it sounds like you're looking forward to some new normalcy there. Let's go to you, Dr. Asumu, for answers to those questions.
So first of all, Chris, I want to congratulate you for getting online and for getting your first shot, and you're contributing to getting all of us back to the new normal. So first thing is, you know, first of all, you're aware that we like to wait for the 2 weeks because to be fully immunized, because that's when your body has had an opportunity to make all those antibodies that are going to protect you. But because, you know, the majority of people in Massachusetts and also the majority of people in the country, even though about 10% of people have been vaccinated, 90% have not yet been vaccinated and are not protected, it's going to take us still a while to get back to the new normal. So what does that mean? The good news is last week, you've probably heard the good news from the CDC and Dr. Walensky, who shared the recommendation from the CDC as to what we can and can't do. So the good news is, in terms of, you know, getting together with people within your household who are at low risk, if it is from one household, you can go see them. You can, you know, if they're low risk, you can take off your mask. So this is going to be gradual. And this is, you know, one of the things that we're recommending for people. In terms of other activities that you've listed, you know, going to restaurants, you know, I would love to be able to support our restaurants. I get takeout all the time, but indoor dining is still something that we would still recommend to limit and not do as much because, you know, there's still, you know, a lot of infections in the community and their variants. So until we all, a majority of people have been vaccinated, we're still recommending to limit certain activities. Another one that you've mentioned is getting your hair colored and other things. You know, we still sort of recommend that until the majority of people in the community have been vaccinated, that we still follow, you know, a lot of the public health measures that we've been recommending. I know it's probably tiring to hear, but there is some good news that there are certain things that we can do in households that are lower risk. We still recommend that even with other people who may be at higher risk, we can go outside and still connect. But for a lot of some of the other activities, such as traveling, even you've probably heard Dr. Walensky say that, you know, traveling, we still, you know, only recommend, you know, necessary travel and sort of watch that. And then getting back to your question about the single shots. First of all, I'm an infectious disease specialist, and I'm really excited to hear that you're getting all your vaccines. And so that's really great news. So usually, you know, the reason why, so we don't recommend taking two vaccines at the same time is because if you do have a reaction, it'll be hard for us to tell which vaccine, you know, may have created the reaction and for us to be able to make recommendations for you in the future. So the good thing is you're separating these vaccines, you're separating by a couple of weeks. And I think that should be enough. And that should be fine for you. But I would, again, I don't know your personal history, so I would recommend that you specifically talk to your doctors. But as long as you're separating them by a couple of weeks, that should be fine. The other thing that I would also tell you is that the shingles vaccine also has been associated with some of the symptoms like fatigue and being tired, maybe having a little bit of fever that some people have also had with the COVID vaccine. But I must say that as an infectious disease specialist, I am very eager and excited to see that you're getting all your vaccines and protecting yourself and protecting the community.
All right, there you go, Chris. There's your answers. Dr. Gill, I'm going to put a couple questions together for you now. 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go to Louise in Westford first. Louise, go ahead.
Yes, hi there. I had my first Moderna shot about 2.5 weeks ago, and I tolerated it quite well. I just had, you know, what I expected, kind of the punch in the arm feeling, and after 24 hours, I felt kind of tired and achy. But then everything went away, and 2 weeks to the day, I got a allergic reaction. It was localized, nothing to worry about, but I had never heard of it. It was about the size of a silver dollar, red, itchy, raised, hot to the touch. It lasted for about 3 days. I did call my doctor, said it was nothing to worry about, and that some people get these more usually after 8 or 9 days rather than 2 weeks, but I thought that was a little bit strange. And I do have a rare condition called CVID that stands for common variable immune deficiency. And I was wondering if that could have anything to do with my reaction, and also if that could have anything to do with how well the vaccine will cover me.
Thanks for that, Louise. I'm going to add one other question, Dr. Gill. We've got Ryan on the line for Dorchester. Ryan, go ahead.
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller. I would just want to know, after everybody gets all these shots, when is Biden going to turn on the microchips?
Oh, so microchip? Ryan, nah, so every once in a while this happens, we'll have a caller who tells our producer that they're calling about one thing, and then when they get on the air, that's not really what they're calling about. So what I thought Ryan's other question, what real question was, and I think this goes with Louise, Dr. Gill, is questions about percentage of people who do have allergic reactions, which may be one of the things Louise was asking about. So let's sure. focus there. Her localized response 2 weeks later, and how often people do have allergic reactions to the vaccines.
Sure. So, Louise, those are excellent questions, all of them. And your question is particularly interesting in light of the CVID, which, for those who don't know, this is a condition where your body has difficulty making antibodies, and you know therefore you're somewhat more vulnerable to infections caused by bacteria or viruses. So, you know, first to unpack the adverse event that you experience, which sounds like urticaria. So it is entirely possible. I think we can't prove it one way or the other, but I think it's entirely possible that this reaction was triggered by the vaccination in some way. The good news, however, is that that urticaria is a very mild and common side effect. And as you experienced it, it came and it went after a couple of days. It might have been itchy and might have been, you know, something you don't want to look at, but it is not a dangerous thing. And it doesn't pretend the really serious thing that we're worried about, which is what we call anaphylactic shock, where like a bee sting allergy or peanut allergy, where people swell up and they can't breathe and they, you know, can actually become seriously ill. So this is not that. Whether this could be something that you experienced because of the CVID, it's a really interesting theory. I don't know either way, but I wouldn't discount your theory. I think it's perfectly reasonable to ask that and wonder. But I think the more important thing is that this does not portend a more serious reaction for you when you have the second dose. So I hope that's reassuring. Now the second part of her question was whether CVID, her condition of CVID, might reduce the immune response to some degree. And the answer of that is probably yes, because this immune deficiency is characterized by a difficulty in producing antibodies. And so one would think that since vaccines mainly work through generating antibodies, that you're right, that, you know, your level of protection might not be as robust as someone else's who didn't have CVID. But how much relatively and how much does that matter is a very difficult question to answer, because what we've seen with both the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine is that the immune response to the second dose is really powerful. So, you know, if you see the rise of your antibodies from undetectable immediately after dose one to post dose one, you see a rise from zero to maybe, you know, a couple hundred ELISA units, which is how we measure the concentration of antibodies. But after dose two, you're way up in the thousands. So I would think that even if you have this condition, that the level of protection you're going to receive from the second dose is still well above what you would need to be protected. So I think I would not be terribly concerned about that, actually.
So now I'm going to turn to the two of you. And, you know, Ryan called and joking, I don't know if he was joking, asked about the microchip, right, which we know is one of the many theories of concern that people have around what could be in this vaccine and what is the government's intention. And we know that there is a range of vaccine hesitancy out there. One of the things that has been interesting is the latest data is showing that that's starting to draw along political lines there being a political bent to whether or not you want to get the vaccine. How do we address vaccine hesitancy as politics?
Tiziana, can I try to answer that one? Because I think that there are two issues at play here. The first one is what you mentioned, vaccine hesitancy. And I want to really emphasize that vaccine hesitancy is not necessarily logical. You know, these are brand new vaccines. you know, there's much that we don't know about them. And so it is reasonable and appropriate, I would say, actually, that some people would be like cautious, you know, with this, what is this new thing? What could happen? What could happen in 6 months? We don't know. The vaccines have only been around for 2 months. What could happen in 6 years? We won't know for 6 years. I mean, these are all legitimate questions. And I think people should think hard about the risk benefit. And I think it is clear that in the current environment where COVID-19 transmission is very high still, that the benefit, based on what we know about the safety, clearly outweighs the risks. But that is distinct from what I think we're seeing, like, you know, suggested by Ryan's comment about the, you know, when are the microchips coming, which sounds like, you know, a conspiracy.
Right. Which are not in the vaccines, right?
Which are not in the vaccines. You know, yesterday, for example, I had a question from a reporter who wanted to know about the fear of aluminum in vaccines. Now, this is really fascinating because aluminum has been studied ad nauseum, and it is, you know, the amounts that are found in pediatric vaccines, which is where aluminum salts are used as an adjuvant, are really trivial, right? You know, less than what is found in breast milk. And yet this is a trope that just rises again and again and again and again. And we're constantly having to play this game of whack-a-mole to sort of push back this mischaracterization. And it's particularly ironic in the current case because none of the COVID vaccines, including the AstraZeneca vaccine, which hasn't yet been licensed, include any aluminum at all. So it's totally irrelevant. And yet this is the argument that's put forward. And I think that's distinct from vaccine hesitancy, because these questions about aluminum or microchips or the more conspiracy theory laden answers are actually, I think, rather disingenuous, because they're not starting from any factual basis. There is no aluminum in any of these COVID vaccines. And so we don't even need to be talking about it. So why does this keep coming up? And of course, people who are raising these things can do what I do, which is to go onto Google and look up the VRBPAC documents for each of these vaccines. I think you'd see perfectly well that there's no aluminum in them. It's not a mystery. And yet here we are.
Appreciate that, Dr. Gill. We have a bunch of questions. So Dr. Osumu, I'm going to match you up with another caller. We've got Jill on the line from Walpole. Jill, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm wondering, I have a 17-year-old son who's a grocery store worker. I have signed him up on the mass vaccination site. Am I safe to assume that if he gets called up to, say, go to Gillette, which is right down the street, that they will know he can only get the Pfizer because he is 17?
So that's
good
a
question.
Great question. So first of all, I am so encouraged to get all these questions from people who are either got one shot or are ready to get vaccinated, because this is how we're all going to get to the new normal. So yes, the people at Gillette will know which vaccine to give him. Because the only vaccine that's been authorized for patients, you know, the one that's allowed between 16 and up is the Pfizer vaccine. The Moderna was only authorized for 18. So the people who are at Gillette will know, because this is actually the only one that he could have. So I think you're in safe hands.
All right, let's grab another call here. We've got Joel on the line from Jamaica Plain. Joel, go ahead.
When the Pfizer vaccine came out, it was announced that it required ultra-cold storage in a unit that had temperature down to just a few degrees above absolute zeros. Units like this are not normally found in medical or pharmaceutical facilities, and yet these days the Pfizer vaccine is in very wide distribution. What's the answer to this apparent contradiction?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How'd we solve for that?
Okay, sure.
Dr. Gill.
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think we'll start by asking the question that precedes yours, which is, why is the Pfizer vaccine stored at this, you know, has it been stored at this ultra low temperature to begin with? And the answer is probably not a very satisfactory answer, which was the decision was made at the very beginning based on an abundance of caution. So we know that RNA is a very unstable molecule and needs to be kept ultra cold to stop it from basically degenerating over time. And so it is a prudent thing to do when thinking about a vaccine that is based on RNA. But as it turns out, Pfizer recently released new data showing that the storage conditions, the minus 80 centigrade, for example, turn out not to be actually all that important. And so they have issued new guidance that the storage can be under much more realistic, shall we say, conditions that could be attained, say, in a hospital, but probably not in a pediatrician's office or at a CVS, because they would still not have like a minus 20 freezer, which is still a fairly expensive and complicated bit of machinery. Now, the way this is actually executed, though, is that these vaccines are shipped in essentially high-tech freezer bags, if you will, packed on dry ice. And so the facilities that receive them don't need to have local capacity to keep it, you know, in a freezer at minus 20 or even, or certainly not at minus 80. They don't need to be able to do that because they're packed to be used in a short period of time. And so the way this is working right now is that there's a sort of dance between supply and demand. And so the companies are trying to ship these packs so that the dry ice does not deplete by the time that they would be used. And so they're doling out the supplies as fast as they can be demonstrated to be usable at the sites. Like, so at Gillette, you know, they can maybe do 1,000, 2,000 people a day. And so Pfizer wants to balance its shipments to Gillette so that it you know, provides that same number of vaccines. So you don't have many left over at the end of each day after the dry ice starts to dissipate. So that's basically how it's happened. It's not assuming that these facilities would have a minus 80 freezer or even a minus 20 freezer. It is really an issue of trying to balance the use rate with the delivery rate so that the cold temperature is maintained by the freezer bags and the dry ice, not by the local freezers.
All right, let's see if we can grab one more. We're on limited time, so we'll try to keep the question and the answer short. We've got David on the line in Natick. David, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm a supply driver by trade, and I'm a bit confused as to the timeline of when people in my business would be able to get the COVID vaccine.
Supply of what kind, David, just so we know?
Oh, just office supplies.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Asumu, do you know, is he March 22nd or later? Do you know?
Well, I think... I'm trying to remember. So great. First of all, I am so encouraged to hear that so many people are interested in getting vaccinated. So in terms of the March 22nd, my understanding was that it included, first of all, people who were greater than 60 years of age, and also workers in certain sectors, such as food and agricultural, sanitation, public works, healthcare workers, and grocery. So it's a little bit unclear to me. So I am not really sure. So I will probably recommend that you connect with your supervisor to see what your job is classified under. And I wonder if maybe there's another way that you can get your vaccine earlier, like your age cutoff. Like if you were, the age cutoff is greater than 60 for March 22nd, April 5th, and then the age will be April 19th for the general public. But it's coming up pretty quickly. So even if you have to wait a little longer, it's not going to be that much longer.
Yeah, and I looked at mass.gov. I'm looking right now, and in that group of essential workers, it just doesn't say clearly either way on the website. So it would be good, I think, to check in with the supervisor. Okay, we have just a little bit of time left. We're not going to have time for more calls here. Callers, you know we will do this again. We do it every week, so if we didn't get to you today, we will in the future. In the last 30 seconds, really, Dr. Gill, let's just reiterate for everyone how confident they can feel that these vaccines are safe.
Yeah, so we have seen data now based on tens of millions of individuals, and particularly good data from Israel, where half the country has been vaccinated. And actually, the vaccines have proven, and I think even beyond my expectations, to be remarkably safe. And even better, remarkably effective. We've seen, in fact, that the administration of even a single dose seems to be highly effective. And that's been shown in Scotland as well as in Israel.
Wonderful. Dr. Christopher Gill, repeat doctor for us. Thank you so much. And Dr. Sabrina Asumu, a new doctor for us. Thanks to both of you. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Thank you for having me on.